This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
All right, it is 6:05 in the evening. But before we get into our story about Kalwat and raiding people in the middle of the night, we've had a tremendous response, much more than we expected, to this idea of a female James Bond.
A lot of people feel very strongly, Uma. What can I tell you? Robert says, Wonder Woman could be a one-off coinciding with Me Too. Previous attempts like Modesty Blaze, Lara Croft and Elektra did not do too well. I've read most James Bond, including those not by Ian Fleming. A female Bond? Blasphemy.
I disagree with Robert, actually. Lara Croft and Elektra were just terribly written films, and they weren't necessarily made very well. The reason Wonder Woman succeeded wasn't because of Me Too. Actually, it was released before the whole Me Too explosion.
The height of it, yes.
No, I think Wonder Woman was just very well made. It's as simple as that.
Another message, yes, for Lady James Bond, but only after Henry Golding's tenure. Ha ha ha. Rosman writing the script, actually. I like the idea of a James Bond spin-off featuring a Lady Bond. James Bond has a daughter he didn't know about. She's Jane Bond, a new graduate recruit at MI6. She used her mother's maiden name, so nobody knows she's the daughter
fantastic.
Of Bond.
Rosman, thank you so much. If Hollywood steals your idea, you can tell them we've got your WhatsApp like timestamped.
That's right. Feel free to use it in a legal case. Boy Mew Hing says, regarding the Bond issue, let's be more creative and avoid having another lead, quote-unquote, lady or lead non-white person to override every successful institution just so that we look politically right or fair. What's wrong with a white male chauvinistic Bond? Let it be. And then we move on to create another iconic female or non-white male hero. I agree with that.
Yeah.
And then we also spoke about whether or not jokes about, the fall of the mighty of our former prime minister and his wife, whether those are fair game anymore. Says part of me says kasianla, but another part of me says no mercy. Jagdish says laughing at ourselves is a dying art and an important slice of our culture. We're always walking on eggshells. Nyam, not in our culture to make fun of persons who are in serious trouble arising from their mistakes or wrongs. It's sad that we're in this serious predicament resulting from the blunder and they're plundering. So really a lot of conflicting viewpoints.
But I have to say, it doesn't matter whether where your political ideologies lie. I think even liberals, conservatives alike have, when it comes to an issue that's meaningful to them, they lose their sense of humor about it because it is so meaningful, right? It maybe inspires a sense of rage about something and then we forget that we should find some humor in something like, no, it's all downhill.
A lot of people do feel extremely angered, though, by what has happened. And I think perhaps the intensity of that anger makes it a little bit hard to have some distance. And that's understandable, too.
I think so, yeah. Let's take a look at Kalwat raids, speaking of anger and distance.
Lack thereof.
Earlier this weekend, our Minister of Religious Affairs, Datuk Mujahid Rawa Yusof, had been quoted as saying that no more Kalwat raids in Malaysia. No more moral policing. Immediately after that, very, very soon after that, he came out and went, oh, wait, I have been misquoted. He does this a lot, by the way. It was over the LGBT issue. He's constantly being misquoted.
Now, if you were to read the actual article on The Star, what he is quoted as saying is something to the effect of he is in charge of Islam in the public sphere, and therefore what happens in the private sphere, in the sanctity of people's homes, in their private lives, that is outside of what he looks after.
Yes.
So that's what he's saying, and I think that's what he's said he's comfortable as having said, I suppose. But it's the insistence on no more Kalwat raids that seems to have gone down wrong. And I think he's come under fire for quite a lot of it as well, from more conservative quarters, also because it is under the jurisdiction of individual states to decide whether or not to do that.
That's right. So, and I think what he has accused the Star of doing was actually putting words in his mouth. And I believe that his aide has actually demanded an apology for this inaccurate Kalwat report.
Because of a misleading headline, actually. I think the report, nobody is sort of getting mad at what is within the report. People are getting mad at the headlines, or rather the ministry is getting mad at the headlines and saying that also the people who have, I mean, he's, Dr. Mujahid has also come out to say that if you are critiquing him for what he said, read the article, don't just read the headline.
Yes, I agree. However, I have to add that at this point, whatever Dr. Mujahid said is quite irrelevant, because this question was asked to Mahathir about what he felt about this no longer of moral policing, and the Prime Minister went, yeah, it's a good idea. So clearly he's been overridden.
And I think there's also been, I mean, it's a very long-running conversation in our country. It's not a nice feeling, I suppose, to know that at any point your door could be knocked down, and, you know, raids are terrifying. So the idea of doing away with them, especially within a private setting, it's an important thing to have said.
You know, a few years ago, the former, head of ideas had faced off with a little issue with a raid in a hotel room. And of course, he was with his mum. And they were banging on his door. And I think he lodged a report against them. And, you know, so it could happen to anyone. It is an embarrassing, it is a frightening situation, more so when you're not in the wrong, right? And also, I mean, here's the other question that no one actually talks about. There is a tremendous amount of corruption that actually plays into all of this as well.
What I'm curious about overall is, how do we determine what's considered public and private? I mean, it's one thing to say that if it's in somebody's home, therefore it is private. But if a report is made, then does that line become blurred? Because if your neighbour makes a report, for example, where does that lie? Yeah, where do you stand?
Ironically, it's interesting. In trying to have this conversation, right, the Pakatan Harapan government are trying to kind of tread very lightly, because they don't want to alienate their base any more than they have. And their base, of course, is made up of a lot of liberal people too. But they want
super
to try
liberals
and super liberals or ultra liberals. And they want to win back some of the conservatives. And so we've got a same line coming out of Dr. Mujahid Rawa, Dato' Sri Wan Aziza, even Dato' Sri Anwar Ibrahim, when he was campaigning in PD, said the same thing. I'm not for gay marriage. But what you do in the privacy of your own home is your business. So that seems to be the line, this don't ask, don't tell line, right? But for a bigger conversation on moral policing, we have on the line Sharia lawyer Nizam Bashe. Nizam, thank you so much for joining us on the program. Does any other country have laws that are similar to the Khalwat laws that we have here?
Well, a similar legislation exists in Aceh, Indonesia. It's known as the Kanun on Khalwat, Improper Covert Association Kanun number 14 of 2003. It sounds like the title to a Tom Cruise Mission Impossible movie, but that's the name of the legislation. I imagine there are similar legislations in other parts of the world, except that I've not been able to identify exactly what those legislations provide.
And how do we come to have these laws in the first place?
The prohibition against Khalwat is not explicitly found in the Quran. Zina is, of course, and Khalwat is meant to be a measure preventive of zina. But verses in the Quran, such as chapter 17, verse 32, supports the principle that there should be measures preventive of zina. Nevertheless, if you move past the Quran itself, there are various hadiths or prophetic traditions on the question of Khalwat. You know, as best as I can tell, if you look at the laws in Malaysia, the laws on Khalwat, you can actually trace them as early as 1909. So it's been around for the better part of a century. In the 1930s, for example, the legislation in question used the phrase, a male Muslim being found in retirement and in suspicious proximity with a female. Yeah, it was only in 1952 that the phrase Khalwat came into being in legislative form in Malaysia. So it's been around.
And from what I understand, Khalwat laws differ from state to state. What are some of those differences?
I just took a look at what the respective states provide on this question. There are very minor variations in terms of Khalwat laws. And I think you can sort of categorize them into three categories. A large number of states have been quite content to sort of legislate Khalwat laws on the basis of being found together with one or more men or women in a place under circumstances which give rise to suspicion. So federal territories, Selangor, Perak, Terengganu, Penang, Johor, Pahang, and Sarawak all use that phraseology in creating Khalwat offences. Sabah, interestingly, was a bit more explicit or specific in terms of how the offence is committed. It is only when parties are found living together, cohabiting, confining, or hiding. So it's not merely being found together, as opposed to all the other states that I mentioned. Negeri Sembilan is quite peculiar in the sense that it seems to be the only state that doesn't have specific khalwat provisions, but it has, in Section 61, doing an act preparatory to the commission of illicit intercourse, and it says that that is an offence. So Negeri Sembilan is quite singular in that sense.
So besides Sabah and Negeri Sembilan, for the other states, what are the specific elements that determine a khalwat offence?
Well, the key elements in those other states, the majority of the states in Malaysia, is being found together. That would be the first element. The second element is you must be found together with one or more men or women. The third element is it must be in a place under circumstances which give rise to suspicion that they were engaged in immoral acts. So essentially, merely being together with one or more men or women is not sufficient. It must be in circumstances which give rise to suspicion. And the suspicion is not mere suspicion. It has got to be suspicion with regards to being engaged in immoral acts.
Right. So how is evidence currently being considered under the khalwat laws?
Evidence where khalwat offences are concerned, it can range from a variety of factors. Typically, what happens is, religious authorities will go into certain establishments and, inspect the occupants. In the past, that has been the case. Generally, they go to budget hotels and, they knock on the door and, they inspect whether couples in those places are married or otherwise. And if they are not, they are subject to being charged for khalwat.
So for people who have been subject to these raids, is it often that they challenge them in court? And what are the usual outcomes?
Unfortunately, most who have been caught for khalwat offences generally plead guilty. It's a question of practicality. Frankly, it's cheaper to pay the fine as opposed to engaging the services of a lawyer. So the fines can vary from 2,000 to 3,000 per person. So, whereas engaging the services of a lawyer may cost more than that. But beyond parties who have sort of pleaded guilty, of course, there have been also instances where the parties in question have challenged the prosecution against them. In those cases, we have seen in some instances the accused have been released. The one that comes to mind particularly was the one involving a Sharia judge who was charged for khalwat, but he was ultimately found to not guilty by the court, as he was able to produce marriage documents. So, as long as the facts are suitable, I'm fairly certain that these matters can be appropriately challenged in court.
And what have you seen to be consequences of these khalwat laws?
One of the unfortunate sort of consequences, I suppose, is we've read of cases, seen cases, people who, in their efforts to avoid being caught, they have injured themselves. Some have even fallen to their death, in particular if the location was some apartment or a condo. So there is a cost to lives because of the enforcement of khalwat cases. And the other regrettable consequence is, when the media is invited to come along on this khalwat raids, privacy considerations appear to be the last things on the minds of the authorities when dealing with individuals in these cases. And I think that's quite deplorable because, some of those offenders may be first-time offenders. And they shouldn't be shamed in that way.
Dr. Mujahid clarified in a press conference today that he's up for strengthening SOPs to prevent misuse of khalwat laws. Here is a little relevant piece of audio from the press conference.
So based on this, compassionate Islam, you have to have a very strong procedural before you can do such raid. This is what it means. Not just get them and you get the information and straight away you commit to the raid. But you must remember, even at present today, there are SOP. We are looking into improving it so that all these issues about penguatkuasaan must have a solid evidence and must have also a good ground whether it encroaches to the public spheres.
Nizam, listening to that, what are your thoughts?
Well, I'm all for improving the state of how Sharia criminal enforcement is being done at this point in time. In fact, my personal view is that I think Khalwat laws should be reconsidered, as although I agree with the idea of enjoining the good and prohibiting the bad, I agree that it's important in Islam. But nevertheless, privacy is an equally important consideration in Islam. So on that note, while I also take cognizance of the calls by religious leaders that Khalwat laws are necessary to prevent vice, I think special mention must go to the Duli Yang Teramat Mulia Pemangku Raja Pahang for emphasizing awareness programs as one way forward as opposed to being fixated with crime or punishment. So I suppose if you try and reconcile the two positions, that is to say by religious leaders who say that Khalwat laws are necessary to prevent vice, and Pemangku Raja Pahang's position that, you know, we should look at awareness programs. So I think certainly the Learned Minister's suggestion that we review the SOP for Khalwat laws, I think that's a good suggestion. As I pointed out earlier, there's a consequence to all these Khalwat raids. Privacy considerations appears to be lost on the enforcement officers sometimes. There's a cost to lives. Parties are unnecessarily shamed. So certainly, I think it's quite timely that we are re-looking at aspects of enforcement in this regard.
So the minister also responded to a reporter's question about the demarcation between private and public sphere, that it's only a problem when, say, a neighbour makes complaints. Here's a relevant audio from this afternoon's press conference.
What you do in your private space, it is not of our concern in terms of me as the government. You as a Muslim, if you see your neighbor do something bad, then that is your responsibility to advise your neighbor. I'm talking on my side as the authority. How do you define this private space is encroached into the public one? It can be in many forms. If you are living in a taman, then you have one house which for so many consistent times seen to be committing something wrong. The neighbor don't feel good about it. And the whole community don't feel good about it because it encroaches into their children, their family, in terms of that little house that they saw as their neighbor is doing something wrong. Okay? So they go to the officers and make complaints. And when they do that, that's the SOP that comes in. They're going to check, tengok betul ke? Atau this guy is just, dia seorang saja. Orang lain tak ada hal pun. Ataupun dia seorang saja nak menimbulkan masalah. Walhal tak ada pun. So these are the question yang kita tak boleh take things easy. And this is what it means. Okay? But if you do it in your private home, which is to my standard is wrong, tapi no complaint, and orang tak bising ke apa, There's nothing wrong with my jurisdiction there.
Nizam, what do you make of that distinction that the minister just made between the private and public sphere?
Well, I think different considerations should certainly apply to matters done in public and things which are done in private. I think we should certainly be a little bit more, I think, forceful when things are done in public. And when things are done in private, I think we should be a little bit more cautious and maybe, you know, assume the best approach or assume the best attitude with regards to what parties may be doing behind closed doors. And this is not, you know, merely my say-so. That's how we should be looking at it. You have prophetic traditions on this as well, you know, where there's a prohibition, well, not just prophetic traditions. In fact, there's a Quranic verse on this as well. That parties are not meant to spy. Parties are not meant to intrude in someone's privacy. Yeah. So when the learned minister was making that demarcation between the private and public sphere, I'm quite certain that's exactly what he had in mind as well. And I think That's one of the things that perhaps we should be also looking at when drawing up or redrawing that SOP on Khawgat matters.
Nizam, one last question before we let you go. What are your thoughts on the backlash that Dr. Mujahid has had to face from more conservative quarters after the initial Star headlines and its report?
Well, I think that's quite understandable because, you have parties who are tasked with looking at, upholding tenets of the religion. So that's their jurisdiction. But when they were saying that, one of the remarks they made was, they said, look, this is Islamic law is state matter. I personally think that's a bit problematic because not everything on Islamic law is necessarily a state matter because liberties, for example, which is, part two of the federal constitution, I think that's a matter that concerns everyone. So we need to work out exactly how to deal with shared areas of concerns. Yeah. So fundamental liberties certainly is something that the state cannot say, or Islamic authorities cannot say, is not the concern of the federal government. The federal government is perfectly entitled to look at fundamental liberties and to voice out their concerns if, for example, Islamic law has been enacted in a way that encroaches upon fundamental liberties in a way that was never envisaged by the framers of the Constitution. So perhaps when comments are made against a proposal made by the Learned Minister, they should be a little bit more moderate in the calls that they are making, because I think certainly whatever suggestions he was making, it was not out of place. He was certainly acting within his power, certainly acting within the scope of his ministry when he expressed his views.
Thank you very much for your perspective, Nizam. That was civil and Sharia lawyer Nizam Bashe on, many things, including the distinction between private and public spaces. And, I can't put my finger on it. I don't know if something offends, say, my religious sensibilities, whether I have a right to call you out on it, for example, then.
Depends what the religion is in this country, I think, and also where you are and how much that intrusion applies. Sadly, that just seems to be the case of it.
All right, we've got more stories coming your way, but first, the news. So keep it here on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.